Campus FM presents DISCERN's Benjamin Tonna Lecture, To Be or Not to Be, A Global Dilemma, by Professor John Stone.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I think I must congratulate you for challenging the weather, really, to come this evening. I'd like to begin with two quotes tonight. Open quote. Let us begin by dispensing with the coy of euphemism of multiculturalism as a stand-in for multiracialism. And if minorities were public restrooms or some other entity requiring verbal camouflage to appear in polite society, let us take multiculturalism in its only possible honest sense as meaning the idea that individuals, institutions, and nations should possess a multitude of different cultures. In that case, the ultimate problem with multiculturalism is none of the things that have been eloquently dissected in this magazine. It is that multiculturalism does not really believe in what ought logically to be its core concept, culture. End quote. And the second quote is this. While Catholic ethicists prior to the council were balanced and restrained, by the 1960s, many in the church unthinkingly aligned themselves with all aspects of the anti-racist or desegregation movement. Not only positive elements, but highly dubious ones as well. By contrast, the traditional axiom should be invoked today is that the church favors neither forced segregation nor forced integration. These quotes are taken from two different articles which are linked to the website of Alleanza Nazionale Repubblicana. Similar voices have been heard from other quarters in our island and have also been the topic of political meetings and TV chat shows. It is sociologically understandable that in a Catholic country, racism and xenophobia are not only associated with culture, identity, and nation, but also they are associated with religion. And this is extremely misleading and dangerous. I cannot scientifically affirm or deny whether racism or xenophobia in Malta are on the increase. Neither do I, at the present moment, necessarily see the red light. However, I definitely see the amber light. I believe it is our duty and the duty of our institute to study these issues in depth because of their social and ethical significance. Thus, it is with great pleasure to me to welcome my friend Professor John Stone, who is going to deliver this year's Benjamin Tonna Lecture on these issues. Professor Stone is a pure Londoner, so tonight he is missing Chelsea, really. He graduated in economics from the University of Cambridge and subsequently earned a doctorate in sociology, the decent science, from Oxford. He held an assistant professorship at Columbia University and has been a fellow in race relations and African studies at Oxford. In 1980, he moved to the University of London, where he was successively reader, professor, and chair of the Department of Social Science and Administration at Goldsmiths College, where he was also deputy dean of the School of Social and Mathematical Sciences. Then in 1988, he moved to George Mason University as chair of the Department of Sociology. From there, he moved to Boston University as chair of the department, a post he currently holds. His research interests are in comparative race and ethnic relations and sociological theory. He has got a long list of publications, so I should skip this. His academic curriculum is too long to go on before he starts. However, tonight he is going to speak to us on a very important issue. He is the founder editor of Race and Ethnic Relations Review. And today he's going to speak about the global dilemma which diversity poses to many nations.
Well, you can see I'm a technological whiz kid as I can't get the light on, but it probably won't make much difference anyway. Thank you very much, Father Joe, for that very kind introduction, and above all for inviting me back to Malta after a number of years. It's always a wonderful pleasure to be here in this very beautiful island with such warm and friendly people. Apparently not all of them are quite so warm and friendly to outsiders, and I think Joe, who manages to fix all sorts of things, seems to have had a word with the chief editor of the Malta Times today to make sure that the news coverage fits in exactly with the topic that I'm going to discuss. As you may have noticed on the front page, there was an article about the illegal immigrants' march to the airport, the breakout from B block of Safi Detention Center, and all the associated concerns and interests that that raises. Then if you turn to the back page, you'll see another article that is linked to changes in Australian citizenship law. And this is to do with those Maltese children that were born in Australia and then came back to Malta to study and to work. And because of the dual citizenship laws in Australia and I think in Malta as well, they had to renounce their Australian citizenship. And the new legislation that is being contemplated is to restore the right to Australian citizenship for those Maltese, well, children of Maltese migrants that were born in Australia. And the comments at the end of that article, I think, are rather interesting. The author concludes, "We will continue our crusade on the issue of citizenship until governments really understand we live in a mobile global world." I think in those two incidents, those two reports, you see both sides of the issue, both sides of what is going on in an increasingly mobile global society where people are moving to and from different societies based on a whole series of political and economic factors. And this ties in with the basic problems that I want to address in today's talk, which looks partly at problems of nationalism, definitions of nationalism, and current debates on nationalism, and tries to link it in with recent research on race and ethnic relations, how the two interplay with each other and overlap in a world that is becoming more globalized and, of course, is facing problems of security linked to global terrorism and similar important developments. Arguments over the past few decades concerning the intrinsic nature of nations and nationalism have produced a fertile discussion about how modern individuals relate to community and what they consider to be the legitimate forms of political representation. The meaning of national identity is a question that has become increasingly salient in the aftermath of the Cold War, and concerns about globalization in a non-ideological environment raise other important issues. As capitalism has spread in one form or another to virtually all societies on every continent, the issue of whether man can live by bread alone has taken on renewed significance. A resurgence of fundamentalist religious forces has often been interpreted as just one reaction to the amoral nature of seemingly unending materialism. Two other forces capable of filling the void in values are various forms of ethnic nationalism and the types of racial affiliation that have so far become so prominent during the irrational rationality of the 20th century. Before turning to the intertwining of these conceptually distinct but often related forms of identity, let me briefly consider the current situation in the debates over nationalism. And this is a debate that is often referred to as the what and when is a nation debate. One axis of nationalism controversy concerns the superficially obvious, but in fact very complex issues surrounding what constitutes a nation. The related question of when national consciousness can be said to have started has also led to diametrically opposed positions. On one side of the dichotomy is the claim that nationalism must be seen as a socially constructed belief system that emerged around the time of the great transformations embedded in the political and economic revolutions of the 18th and 19th centuries. Mass participation and some measure of literacy were an integral part of the process of mobilizing modern individuals on the basis of a sense of community derived from beliefs about shared ancestry, history, and culture. Hobsbawm and Ranger's invention of tradition, Anderson's imagined communities, and the arguments associated with Ernest Gellner's analysis of high culture and mass culture view nationalism as a relatively recent social phenomenon, inextricably linked to the forces of modernity. According to this line of argument, one could invent a nation in just the same manner as one could invent a race. The counterpoint to social constructivism is an emphasis on the historical evidence of certain national groups that appear to have persisted for centuries, if not millennia. How can such collectivities be seen to be the result of rather arbitrary circumstances coming together at some point in time, which then create a sense of national consciousness? To what has become known as ethno-symbolism, advocated most prominently by my friend Anthony Smith at the London School of Economics, the antiquity of nations and the deeply ingrained beliefs in chosen peoples cannot be so simply dismissed. While Smith is far too sophisticated a sociologist to ignore any element of social construction, he argues in favor of placing the evolution of such belief systems in an appropriately historical and cultural context. Certain scholars of nationalism have proceeded further down this road to stress the primordial essence of nationalism, and a few have gone still further to emphasize at least some biogenetic causation. The most prominent advocate of the last position is Pierre Vandenberg, who suggests that there are certain socio-biological factors, like nepotism and inclusive fitness, that must also be built into the causal explanation of the power and persistence of the nationalist message. It would seem that many of the exchanges between the more permanent and the more flexible understandings of nationalism, in so many cases, simplistic dichotomies are often a misrepresentation of what is in reality a continuum, depend on which examples of the phenomenon the scholar is attempting to analyze. Furthermore, it is imperative to know what aspect of the particular definition of nationalism that is the object of scrutiny. For there is nothing inherent in a broad conception of nationalism that precludes both deep historical roots and a relatively recent process of nationalist mobilization. The symbolic themes and the cultural bases of nationalist movements are often constructed from ancient myths and legends, but their coalescence into the building blocks of ethno-national movements is closely bound up in modern forces, like the spread of democratic political ideals, interacting with the complex dynamics of both the divisions within states and interstate rivalries. Thus, current attempts to define and understand the nature and dynamics of nationalism have reached a point that recognizes a variable mix of factors that need to be considered. Modern nationalism, and in particular the forms of national consciousness that have become more salient in an era of globalization, can also be considered against the related developments in the studies of race relations. While race and nation sometimes are viewed as overlapping, virtually all modern societies are increasingly multiracial in character. This is in part the result of changing patterns of international migration that have been stimulated by the economic forces of global capitalism and by political changes that have followed in the wake of the collapse of communism. The demise of apartheid in the 1990s and the continuing changes in the pattern of race relations in the United States have produced a shift from stark divisions along a white-black boundary to a more subtle array of interracial relationships. African Americans are no longer the largest minority in America, being overtaken by the continuing flow of Latino immigrants from Mexico, combined with immigrants from Central and South America. And in four states of the United States, according to the 2000 census, non-whites make up a majority of the population. In this way, the dynamics of race relations have become increasingly complex and variegated. Hybridity, transnationalism, whiteness, polyethnicity, and a whole host of other topics have entered into the contemporary discourse on American race relations. This suggests that the impact of an ever-diverse set of new sources of immigrants, whose distinctive origins are a result of the changes in the immigration laws in 1965, are interacting with an increasingly global environment. The longer-term outcome is a matter of fierce debate, ranging from those who argue that the land border with Mexico raises an altogether new scenario as far as assimilation and adjustment to some core notion of American culture and values is concerned, people like Samuel Huntington, to cite one example, and those who maintain that some form of modified assimilation is a far more realistic evaluation of the empirical evidence, what is really happening. When one adds a dramatically new dimension to the equation, with the escalation of international terrorism in the aftermath of the attacks on the World Trade Center in Manhattan and the Pentagon on September the 11th, 2001, and the implication that these events may be having for the Muslim diaspora, the situation both in America and in Europe becomes even more unpredictable. The complex interaction between terrorism, wars, and more normal patterns of demographic change and global interpenetration demonstrate quite clearly that perceptions of race, ethnicity, and nationalism are interrelated and constantly changing. This can be seen in the problems associated with the successful implementation of conflict resolution measures, whether geared to racial, ethnic, or national disputes, as it depends not simply on traditional interstate diplomacy or collective peacekeeping operations directed by the United Nations, NATO, the African Union, or other multinational organizations, but on the flexible application of a whole range of institutions and policies. And these may include both economic pressures, military intervention, and other techniques. The success of intrastate or interfederation conflict resolution equally depends on a complex mix of policies designed to reduce both the perception and reality of group economic exploitation, the protection of linguistic, cultural, and religious rights, a degree of political autonomy, particularly on core matters of group definition, and a sense of empowerment and respect for difference in a shared environment. The ubiquity of conflict based on constantly changing boundary lines demonstrates just how difficult such a balance is to achieve and then maintain. The democratic transition in South Africa represented another case where forces of nationalism and racism were intertwined with geopolitical and other factors to produce an outcome that was surprising in terms of standard models of social change, violence, and revolution. Under apartheid, stark divisions of race relations were overlapping and interpenetrating a complex bundle of class and ethnic forces. Afrikaner nationalism represented the ressentiment that is often found in reactive response to group humiliation at the hands of British imperialism, something that nobody in Malta would know anything about, of course, imperial contempt for the group language, Afrikaans, hostility to the group's religion represented in the Calvinist mutation that made up the doctrine of the Dutch Reformed Church, a history of disposition, a dispossession from lands that were defined, however myopically, as the rightful inheritance from the Great Trek, all fused together to produce a powerful sense of identity. When this was superimposed on a feudal system of master-servant relationships, defined along the color lines, dividing the powerful minority from the African majority, a seemingly explosive amalgam of race and nation came together. Cross-cutting cleavages that in many situations seemed to ameliorate group conflicts appeared to be totally absent. Thus, the existence of substantial minorities that did not fit within either of the two major group boundaries did not generate bridges between the polarized hierarchy. The Cape Colored community, transparently a hybrid character whose Afrikaans language revealed the origin of many members of this group, demonstrated how race trumped language in the steady evolution of Afrikaner nationalism. Quite why this should have been the case is somewhat surprising, since the threat to a distinct survival of the Afrikaner community lay initially as much from the cosmopolitan influences of the English language, the global commercialism of the Uitlanders, and of course the military might of the British Empire. However, given the subsequent post-Boer War compromise among the South African whites that relegated the African influence in the political system to that of a conquered nation, the division between black and white became the hallmark of apartheid. In much the same way, the South African Indian community, located predominantly in Natal, and despite the early unsuccessful attempts of Gandhi to mobilize opposition to the regime, added little to ameliorate the crude divisions along the color line. Indian South Africans rapidly moved their support behind the non-racial ANC as the only practical strategy to oppose apartheid. The resolution of the apartheid struggle in a relatively peaceful manner provided important insights into the shifting nature of geopolitics. An analysis of the factors that brought this unexpected outcome included a series of developments that systematically undermined the ability of the white elite to sustain a racial state in an economy that had always been dependent on international allies. With the end of the Cold War, the perceived strategic importance of South Africa ceased to be seen as critical to the protection of Western interests in the struggle against communism. This brought enormous pressure on the regime to rethink the options and to decide that the maintenance of a racial state was no longer worth the price that would have to be paid to sustain it. The collapse of apartheid in the early 1990s and its replacement by a non-racial democracy was another development realigning the global perceptions of the color line. What was the resolution of a long and bitter struggle had an important symbolic impact not only in Africa, but also in Europe and the United States by the end of the millennium. As the United States evolved into a far more complex array of disparate groups and forces, this was also true for the emerging scene in Europe. The component states of the enlarged Union do not share a myth of immigrant origin to act as a benchmark for recent racial and ethnic shifts. But as the structure of state units has begun to slowly dissolve and blur, at least on the internal political boundaries of the member states of the EU, this has had significant implications for ethnic and racial relations within the Union, as much as it has for the composition of the constituent parts of the evolving superstate. Flows of migrants that were previously difficult, if not impossible, to sustain have changed the ethnic and racial mix of societies that had traditionally been diversified by migration from the former colonies rather than by extensive inter-European movements. Two illustrations of these dynamic developments can be seen in the steady, if uneven, progress towards peace in Northern Ireland and the reversal of both Ireland and Italy from being societies of emigration to ones that are experiencing the economic, social, and political impact of immigrants. In the first case, the emergence of Brussels as the neutral pole between London and Dublin has helped to mitigate the worst fears of both the Protestant and Catholic communities in Northern Ireland, that the only resolution of the troubles must be the victory of one side over the other. In other words, that the conflict is a zero-sum game. The new political and administrative structure of the European Union suggests that a compromise could work and develop into a genuine win-win outcome. Of course, other factors have played an important role in this realignment. Inasmuch as the post-9/11 concerns about terrorism have questioned the legitimacy of the traditional support found among many Irish Americans for the IRA. And someone working in Boston knows a lot about Irish nationalism. Furthermore, the economic transformations of the Irish Republic into a Celtic tiger, exhibiting sustained economic growth and high levels of economic prosperity, has also been a critical factor in turning a traditional society of emigration into a society attracting many immigrants. Much the same side effects emanating from similar economic prosperity of the Italians in the later decades of the 20th century has also produced an entirely predictable yet ironic reversal of attitudes towards outsiders, many of whom arrived under the aegis of the Greater European Project. Perhaps the largest single challenge facing the future of the EU, following the failure of political leadership in both France and Holland to secure the ratification of the new draft European Constitution last year, is the relationship with Turkey. Incorporating a secular Muslim state with a population the size of Germany raises a barrage of new questions about the emerging ethnic and religious shape of the continent. Not only would such a move further challenge the Christian monopoly on religious identity, but the internal power dynamics of the substantial Islamic communities, numbering between 15 and 20 million people in aggregate, and located in significant proportions in France, Germany, Austria, Belgium, and Switzerland, to a lesser extent in Britain, Denmark, Greece, and Sweden, would almost certainly be profoundly affected. While some observers have argued that the Muslims and the Mexicans fulfill essentially the same function on the two continents, we need to ask to what extent this is a reasonable assessment. Are the consequences of a minority, which is marked out by a distinct world religion, Islam, much the same as those for a minority whose primary boundary is linked to a different world language, Spanish? Bilingualism is easier to acquire and much more flexible option than membership in more than one monotheistic religion. At least I think so. Does a long and continuous land border pose more of a perceived threat to the United States than the religious affiliations of citizens whose faith is currently being challenged by strong fundamentalist movements? It also raises other provocative questions. Will Islamophobia help to reduce the long-standing tensions associated with other types of boundaries by shifting hostile attention away from non-Islamic minorities? Will Latinophobia have a similar impact on African Americans, and particularly their status in the United States? This last question appears rather implausible, Given the relatively rapid assimilation of many Latino groups, notably the Cubans in Miami, although in this case the obsession with Castro has certainly given them an edge over other immigrant refugees like the Haitians, and the persistence of racial discrimination between American whites and blacks in so many fields, in healthcare, housing, education, employment, income, wealth, and social mobility. What then is globalization's impact likely to be on nationalism and race relations? Well, such questions remain at the core of the ethnic enigma for the 21st century. No matter the perspective chosen by scholars of nationalism, there is general agreement that the demise of the state is a long way off, despite the negative impact of much nationalism in the 20th century. Clearly, globalization has reconfigured the strength of certain boundaries, reinforcing some and weakening others, in much the same manner that the forces of decolonization and the ramifications of the end of the Cold War helped to restructure the world's racial system. The long-term implications of such changes, however, are subject to similar patterns of interpretation. Just as many scholars maintain that decolonization was simply replaced by neocolonialism, so contemporary critics of the global economy point to the massive imbalances in wealth and influence symbolized by the leading multinational corporations, whose assets dwarf the gross national product of many independent states. There is considerable evidence to support the basis of such claims, although the actual implications for national identity and race and ethnic relations are much more difficult to predict. It is the processes enhanced by globalization, and more particularly the changes in international migration, both legal and illegal, that are as influential as the corporate institutions per se. This is because in most situations, it is the movement of diverse peoples that is often seen as the more visible challenge to both national boundaries and to the ethnic racial balances of power within states. Another development is the way in which incidents that would have been defined largely as national, that is to say, intrastate matters several decades ago, are now being translated onto a wider and more complicated set of arenas. The racial ramifications of Hurricane Katrina, with television reports revealing the predominantly black faces of the people stranded on the buildings and in the sports arenas for days at a time before any rescue action was taken, quickly became a global metaphor for the Bush administration's priorities with respect to poor blacks in America and, by extension, to the wretched of the earth. As this took place at the same time that the United States was waging a war in Iraq, an intervention in the affairs of a Muslim state, and one deeply resented by most Muslims around the world, the global ramifications of what was essentially the response, or lack of response, to an internal natural disaster quickly became translated into wider ethnic and racial significance. Within a few weeks of these events, the burning vehicles and buildings in the slums around Paris, triggered by the death of two young French Muslims fleeing the police, and the government's attitude towards the behavior of the youth that the Interior Minister initially characterized as the action of scum, set off a chain reaction of arson attacks around France, followed by other further incidents in Belgium and Germany. Attempts to frame such violence in terms of the agitator of fundamentalist clerics, rather than as a clear demonstration of the failure of French policies of immigrant assimilation, seemed increasingly implausible as the minority religious leaders consistently spoke out against the riots. While evidence of patterns of global support for ethnic and racial struggles is by no means new, the speed with which such incidents of ethnic and racial violence are translated onto the world stage adds a new dimension to the dynamics of contemporary conflicts. Thus, nationalism and racism, far from declining or becoming obsolete, have changed shape and must be viewed against the global backdrop. So while global capitalism has, on one dimension, broken down barriers of national autonomy, on another, it has generated new forms of diversity as a result of the need to free up the movement of labor as much as the movement of capital. This, in turn, has revived the debates on the meaning of community and who can be regarded as a legitimate member of what are frequently enlarged political units. As borders within the EU have become more porous and sometimes invisible, the corollary is the hardening of collective boundaries or the exterior shell to produce what has been termed a fortress Europe. This in turn leads to pressures to avoid or circumvent the barriers and to a major issue over illegal immigration. The smuggling of peoples and an internal backlash against what is often perceived and frequently cultivated by politicians wishing to capitalize on xenophobic fears as a threat of an invasion of aliens. The global reach of Al-Qaeda cells with dramatic and lethal terrorist bombings from Madrid to Bali and from London to Amman also creates a related demand for enhanced security measures and for the serious implementation of many border controls that are increasingly difficult to seal. All the evidence, however, suggests that such restrictions are ineffective and that the number of illegal immigrants coming to the United States, for example, now outnumbers the foreigners who come in with visas. This brief and highly selected overview of some of the major trends in ethnicity, nationalism, and race relations confirms the conclusions of those emphasizing the persistence of identification with both nation and race in the new century. The belief that modernity and the moves towards a globalized capitalist world economic system would both undermine attachments to nations or eradicate racial definitions has been shown to be implausible. Modern materialist society seems to lack the cohesiveness and value systems that so many of the peoples of the world crave. Paradoxically, the humanistic and universal values of the Enlightenment failed to provide for many of the vital forms of identity that modern individuals seek to shield themselves from the uncertainties of rapid and discontinuous social change. The quest for Gemeinschaft within Gesellschaft seems to be a better description of modernity than the classical model suggesting a systematic movement in only one direction. Expressions of crude racial ideology may have been ameliorated to some extent in a world where the balance of power has started to shift away from Euro-American domination. But there is persistent evidence of massive disparities in wealth and influence that still follow traditional patterns of racial hierarchy. The revival of fundamentalist versions of all religions can be seen in this context, as indeed the tendency of intellectuals to misunderstand or fail to grasp their importance. There is a greater appreciation that globalization is a much longer and older phenomenon that most theorists of the subject are willing to acknowledge. And the agents and processes are not simply secular, but include religion and warfare, both of which encourage differentiation. Furthermore, while states have been forced to cooperate in larger political and economic groupings for certain purposes, there is little evidence that the active units within such coalitions or inside loose federations are free from the system of nation states. In conclusion, it would seem that the future shape of the global relationships at both the individual and the collective levels will continue to be influenced by both nationalism and race relations and their frequent interaction for many decades to come. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Professor Stone. And now we have a few minutes for questions. I mean, anyone who wants? Yes, Dr. Vassallo.
Good evening. Well, actually, it's a bit disappointed, really, in the sense that it's fascinating. Professor Stone has ranged very far and wide in time and space, but somehow I felt that he really left off what I thought he would actually kick off, in the sense of the question that is confronting Europe nowadays, or Europe amongst others perhaps, but primarily Europe, is to what extent can we extend the benefits of democratic government, of democratic participation, to those within whose core values are not consonant with the democracy in which we live. That's what I thought he would be centering on tonight, and somehow I felt, perhaps I misconstrued the whole thing, that he'd skirted the issue altogether.
Well, thank you very much. It certainly is a slightly difficult question to answer. My inclination, and I recognize what you're pointing to, I think one has got to recognize that it takes time for ideas, cultural values to change. And to respond too quickly to the situation that certain people are incapable of moving towards the political system of the societies in which they move to, I think is a misunderstanding of the normal processes of social change. Provided those people are given a reasonable stake within the society to which they move. And now it may be that some people just adamantly refuse to accept any of the fundamental principles of democracy and so on. But I don't think that that is likely to be the case if you look at one generation after another. If you look, say, at third or fourth generation Germans of Turkish origin, I'm not sure that you will find that there is the hostility towards democratic processes that you will find among the first generation. So the transition into a democratic culture is a slow and gradual one. I'm less inclined to think that you can just simply write people off entirely and say that their value systems are totally incompatible with forms of democracy that, say, Europeans or Americans are more comfortable with. I know that a lot of people would take an opposite, much more pessimistic view. But in terms of trying to structure institutions, we haven't got a lot of options. Either you treat people as second-class citizens and deny them opportunities, or else you try and include them as sensitively as you can. Clearly, the majority society has the right to say there are certain lines where you will not cross. And if you do, you are violating the fundamental laws of this society, and then you must either pay the price or else leave. But I think this is something that is not likely to change rapidly. It is part of an ongoing process. And if you have confidence in the fact that democratic ideals and a democratic society is ultimately the kind of future that most normal, educated people will accept, then I think that is the only path that you have got to take.
Mr. Rajos.
People of my age group will recall the 1960s when Enoch Powell was warning the British people of the dangers of migrants from Asia. How would you rate Enoch Powell's warnings at a distance of 40 years? The reason why I ask this is also that yesterday, I don't know whether you've had the chance to watch Sky News, Muslims were asking for Sharia law to be applied to them in Britain.
Enoch Powell is not one of my favorite political characters. He had a sense of history, but a sense of history that was a slightly warped one. When it comes to historians, I prefer someone like Alexis de Tocqueville, a much older thinker, who had a very interesting debate with a colleague and friend, a man, Arthur de Gobineau. Now, de Gobineau was the founder of European racism and came up with a bestseller in the 1850s called The Inequality of the Human Races. And Tocqueville's response, and Tocqueville is usually known as the great author of Democracy in America, or if you're European, The Old Regime and the Revolution on France. But Tocqueville's correspondence with Gobineau, and this was a friendly exchange, contains some fascinating attacks on the idea that there is sort of fundamental differences between peoples. And his argument was there may be differences at the present time, but in order to say that these differences are fundamental and permanent, you have got to know not only the past, but also the future. And the interesting thing in this case, he cited the attitude that Julius Caesar probably had of the Britons when Caesar came and looked at these woad-covered barbarians and wrote them off as being incapable of doing anything and doomed to rot on the borders of civilization for all time. This debate took place in the middle of the 19th century when Britain was probably the most powerful nation on earth. Whether, in fact, British imperialism was such a good thing, I won't go into, but certainly in terms of the ability of the peoples living in that part of the world to advance the arts, science, and so on, I think is highly, that was definitely the point he was trying to make. Don't write off people, don't take a short-term view of things, and above all, don't believe that differences are immutable, they never change. I agree that there are problems, and of course Sharia law is one such problem. I don't think that Sharia law should be allowed in its classic form in a non-Muslim society. If it's a Muslim-dominated society, that's up to the democratic majority to make those decisions. These issues are clearly part of the problems that need to be sorted out, need to be worked through. And they are not easy, and there are no simple solutions. And I know I disappointed the gentleman at the back by not coming out with a standard formula about how you solve all the national and racial problems in the world permanently. I don't think you ever will or ever can. But there are certain strategies that are probably going to produce better results, and there are other strategies that almost certainly are going to produce terrible results. And I think we've just got to work with our best understanding of the right way to move.
Yes,
what I'd like to ask Dr. Stone is, what does he think about assimilation in an adoptive country, and identity, the retention of identity of one's own country? What I'm aiming at is about this political correctness madness, which is chipping away at one's own identity and beliefs. What do you think, Professor Stone?
Thank you. The first thing about assimilation, again, it's very difficult because assimilation means different things to different people. I think a forced form of assimilation is not likely to be very productive. Living in the United States, where assimilation has been a process that has taken place for most of the European immigrants at a very rapid pace, this is something that has happened in a fairly natural way. America's problems have rarely been of trying to assimilate immigrants. It's dealing with the people that were brought in as slaves and how that problem can be resolved. Assimilation, I think, is something that forced assimilation is obviously not a good thing. If people have to conform totally to every aspect of the society they're moving into. Societies generally have the power to control their major institutions, their laws, and so on. And most people, of course, need to understand that if you're in a society, you must obey the basic laws of that society. How far you go, that is a question that is a major problem. Do you insist, for example, that everybody has to only learn one language? Or is bilingualism a perfectly reasonable way of assimilating into a society? That again depends on the circumstances. So in the United States, many people feel that Spanish is a language that should not be encouraged and point to the lack of success of many Spanish-speaking schools. At the same time, middle-class and upper-middle-class parents are sending their schools to bilingual institutions and trying to get them to learn other international languages. The problem is not bilingualism, the problem is poor education. And bilingualism can be a tremendous asset, and I would argue that the great problem the United States has is the lack of retention of languages. Considering what an immensely diverse population and background that society has, the facility of third, fourth, and fifth generation Americans in other languages is abysmal. And that in a globalized society, a globalized world, is really a handicap. So I don't know whether this has sort of answered the sort of core of what you're saying. I don't think forced assimilation works. I'm not sure that I quite understand that where what you're talking about is the balance of communities to retain their sense of identity, their religious values, and so on.
The country which receives the new immigrants, you know?
Yes.
Right? How can you keep the balance without the adoptive country not losing its identity because of political correctness? That's what I mean.
Well, I think I have problems when you say about a country losing its identity, and maybe because I'm taking an American perspective, a U.S. perspective on what the identity of the United States actually is. The United States has always had a changing, flexible form of definition of what it is to be an American. And it is, as many Americans have argued, not at all times and not in all situations, a society of immigrants, recognizing that virtually all Americans, apart from Native Americans, are immigrants. And the addition of new peoples has actually, over a period of time, strengthened and increased the wide net of American culture and values. It hasn't diminished that society. Now, the problem of political correctness is a totally different thing. And I'm as against people telling you can't open your mouth or say anything about anybody because immediately it's racist, it's sexist, or anything else. That's a pain in the neck. But again, it's a question of getting a balance with communities that may well wish to retain certain values. Certainly religious values can be retained. One can still be American and be of any religion or no religion at all. And I don't think that really has attacked. That is not the weakness of American society. I would feel is the strength of American society.
Now I'm going to take the last question. Yes.
Emigration in Europe is not something new. It has been taking place for many hundreds of years. The same thing, America, as you said, is a nation of immigrants. Why is it that the problem that we are facing today, both in Europe especially and in America, never arose? But only when a certain culture or people belonging to a certain culture come into the picture, that the problem crops up. Before, we never had a problem. There may have been local problems, problems about work or something like that, but not national problems, not cultural problems. How do you explain that?
I'm a little puzzled about the history of the last century in Europe saying that there weren't national problems. I mean, we had two major world wars that were...
They were not connected with immigration. Yeah, they were, but they were not connected with immigration. They were connected with certain ideologies which had nothing to do with immigration. I mean, there were plenty of... Let us take France. There were plenty of Russians in France. There were plenty of Polish in France. There were the same thing in England. Why is it that from Southeast Asia... From India, there are plenty of immigrants in India, and they don't have a problem. Maybe local problems, but not a national problem. But one section of people, they have a problem. Why?
I think this is a very special reading of history. I mean, other societies have had enormous problems with immigrants.
Not in the sense that we are having it today. Not a national problem. It must have been a problem on the question of work, of housing, or things like that. But not a cultural confrontation. Italians, for example, never wanted to make an Italian parliament in England. Or in Belgium, there are plenty of immigrants, Italian immigrants in Belgium. They wanted to have Italian as a second language.
But are you suggesting that contemporary migrants are trying to take over these countries totally into...
Not a general statement, no. Certain immigrants, yes. Certain immigrants belonging to a certain culture, yes. There is that tendency. Not all of them, of course. There will be exceptions.
I think this is a particular reading of history. I mean, there's been a tremendous amount of conflicts associated with immigration all over the place.
Sure.
A lot depends on the extent to which the country controlling immigration can keep immigrants in a position where they are not able to express any views whatsoever.
Which is in the whole of Europe, probably.
Sorry?
It is in most countries of Europe. Not only one single country that is having this problem. It is in Germany, it is in France, it is in Italy, it is in Belgium, it is in Holland, it is in England.
But you're not getting a situation where people are being moved to work as plantation workers or
no, that kind of thing.
It's
okay, but that has...
That's why you didn't have a problem in those days, because the people involved were not in a position to say anything. Whereas nowadays, because of a rather more democratic system, we have encouraged people to express their views. They may be views that we don't like, but that is the price of democracy. In these previous periods, there was no chance of people having any say whatsoever. They just had to do what they were told or else. So I think in one sense, the uncomfortable nature of these clashes that are real clashes, I'm not trying to pretend that they are of no significance, is a product of having an open and free society where people can actually express what they feel. That's the price of democracy.
Thank you, John, for your wide-ranging lecture and for answering these questions. I firmly believe that there is no such thing as an immaculate conception of culture. Culture is the result of people living together, is the result of a melting pot, whether you like it or not. Neither there is an immaculate conception of identity. Identity is the result of our interactions that with whom we are living. We say with whom we are brought up, and those are human beings. And I think the same things happen, the same reality takes place as regards collectivities and collective identities. So I think we should leave this evening thinking that we are seeing hundreds and amounting to thousands now approaching our shores,
having different colors. And I think we should be humble enough to admit that, to say the least, we are a bit prejudiced against certain people and against certain cultures. And I think, looking back at our own history, you should look how our forefathers in the 19th century were accepted as immigrants in North African countries to the extent that they considered North Africa to be a God-given destination for Maltese migration. No one bothered to travel to Australia and much less to the United States. So I think we should approach this problem, which is cropping nowadays because we are interacting, but not only because we are interacting with foreigners, not because we think they are taking our jobs. In fact, when it suits us, we are ready to give them jobs as much as the Germans used to give jobs to the Turks in the time of the Gastarbeit. So I think we should look at these people as human beings in need and judge them on their own values, and not making strong judgments about any value system. Thank you very much.
You have just listened to Discern's Benjamin Tonna lecture, To Be or Not to Be, A Global Dilemma, by Professor John Stone.